Welcome to The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with us this week is Virginia.
Thanks, Andrew. It's great to be back. And with us also this episode is Spencer. Hi, Spencer.
Hey, Virginia, Andrew, everybody else. It's great to be here. Tonight, we are going to start a reread of The Gathering Storm in anticipation of Towers of Midnight coming out in just a few months. So this is exciting. We only got a few months left to wait, as opposed to, you know, the years that we've had between other books. But in anticipation for the release of Towers of Midnight, we are going to go over The Gathering Storm, similar to what we did with Knife of Dreams, only this time we're going to try and actually, you know, get all the way through.
Yeah. We're starting a little earlier this time, in the hopes that we can actually make it before the end.
Yeah, when does it come out? End of October? Yeah, let's start that beginning of October.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was an interesting experiment.
Well, we can read that fast, and we could almost record that fast, but we couldn't get them out the door that fast. We have a better shot now that we have several editors helping us, but still, this is going to be, a couple of recording sessions a week probably for us to get through this, even at this point. As we speak, it is mid-August. So this is going to be Friday the 13th on an auspicious date on which to start our Gathering Storm read-through. Oh my goodness.
It's a great date. 13's my lucky number.
Okay, good. Maybe I lost something. Actually, I'm not triskelophobic, so it won't bother me in the slightest either.
Well, 13 is a very powerful number. Otherwise, how would we gentle and still people?
Well, and the 13 chosen, forsaken, evil people.
All right, this is Brandon Sanderson giving you a warning that this podcast includes spoilers. Spoiler alert, don't listen unless you've read all the books. Otherwise, we will hunt you down and beat you up.
So yes, to begin, we will start in the most logical place of The Gathering Storm, that being the prologue. In the prologue, we have 5 points of view. And contrary to what we did with The Gathering Storm, we're going to go point of view by point of view, because I know one of the things that got mentioned in the Knife of Dreams prologue read-through was that we kind of read through the entire thing and then just randomly talked about whatever came to mind. And so in this case, we are going to break it up, and we're going to discuss each part point of view by point of view in the hopes that it will be a little clearer and we'll be able to focus more on everything that needs to be talked about.
Yeah, that's our plan, and we're going to stick to it, hopefully.
So we open the book with the point of view of a farmer in the Borderlands. His name is Renald Fanwar, who is fascinated by strange and mysterious clouds, black and silver, and moving around very erratically and quite unnaturally. His friend, a blacksmith by the name of Thurlin, drives by in a wagon loaded with his family and most of his possessions. Thurlin stops briefly, and they converse. The blacksmith tells Renald where to find his spare tools and other household items which they have left behind. They say that they are going north, where an army will be gathering because the storm is coming. They will need smiths, and Renald convinces himself that he must take his family and the farmhands north as well. They will need a smith. Renald and his wife, Awain, will go as well. He begins working his two best scythes into pole arms, while the hands gather the livestock and their possessions. I really liked this opening sequence. The weirdness, I almost wondered if Renald was capable of channeling, because to his eyes, he seemed to be the only person to notice the clouds during the entire sequence. And they would, like, be on the distant horizon, and they would leap forward and be threatening right overhead. And he just kept thinking in his mind that, you know, the clouds shouldn't move like that. And then, you know, someone came into view, and suddenly the clouds were back where they were. And it was just, you got this building sense of, things just aren't right. This is maddening. And, you know, and the conversation is kind of tense and awkward. And it's just kind of like, you know, all the hair on your arms is standing up, and you just kind of get this shivery, oh, this is too much. This build up is just going to drive me out of my head. And I thought it was a beautiful opening sequence, particularly for, you know, some character which we have never met before and will probably end up showing back up in the next two books.
Yeah, I have to agree with you, Andrew, there. It was very, very powerful opening emotionally, especially for, like you say, these are characters that we haven't seen before. And yet, in the space of just a few paragraphs that they take up in the prologue, we're introduced to them, we get to know them, we get to empathize with them, and just everything that they're going through. This old farmer who his sons are off on their own farm, and he has young farmhands that come in and help him that aren't related to him because his family's grown up and moved away. This old farmer taking his livelihood, his family, his farmhands, you know, all this, packing up and leaving because the world needs saving. And everyone can feel that. The blacksmith that comes by, his wife doesn't put up any arguments. She's like, yep, yes we do, we gotta go. And just that powerful emotion that came across in this opening scene was absolutely phenomenal.
In a way, it sort of reminded me of the scene where Nynaeve is gathering up the Borderlanders and Sylvan and other places to defile the Golden Crane. And she's not Viren herself, but it almost looks like Viren. She just plays on people's emotions and gets them moving. And this is not without even a major character in sight. These people are drawn to just leave everything, leave their farms, leave their stuff. I mean, when they take some of their stuff with them, but I mean, just pick up everything they've worked a lifetime to build up. And go north because the storm is coming. You know, it's almost like the pull of the Tavern has become so incredibly powerful that everybody is being affected by it, you know, and they're just gone. I mean, they just pick up and go. It's weird. It's crazy. I mean, even he thinks it's crazy when the clouds are jumping back and forth. He questions sanity several times.
Yeah. Well, and I think that might actually be kind of the point. That I don't remember where I heard it, but I'm pretty sure that it was confirmed somewhere along the tour that this portion with Reynold Farnoir was actually written by Robert Jordan. Don't quote me on that because I don't remember where I heard it, but I'm pretty sure. But anyway, I think that was the point that was trying to be made here, was that the Tavernness of these three boys has gotten so strong that it's affecting people that they haven't even known exist. Besides the fact that, yeah, that land is populated, there are people living there, but other than that, that doesn't really connect. But their pull on the pattern is still affecting all of these threads that are spread out so far over the entire map that we have scenes like this, where people are packing up and leaving to go protect their world.
Yeah, I mean, they're just picking up and going like zombies heading for the Apple Store. Oh, wait, that's another series. Never mind. No, it's kind of scary. It really is kind of scary. They you're right. There's not a Tavern in sight. They've never met these people. They probably, in all probability, never will meet these people. And yet, everyone is drawn. And what's even weirder to me is they know where to go. They have a gut-level feeling of where they need to be. And that is just spooky. I mean, when you think about it, seriously spooky.
Well, these are the Borderlands, and they do know the Blight's north, and that's where all the trouble's coming from. And they probably even know where to head to get to Tarwyn's Gap, but still.
And that's true, but there's no guarantee that all of the last battle is going to be fought in any one place. And as far as what you were saying about this part of the prologue being written by Jordan. I don't remember any specifics either, but I think you're right because I sort of have a vague remembering that was the part of the book that Brandon chose to read from at the book signings because it was written by RJ and it was the most his of anything. So I think you're probably right on that. I just can't absolutely say with 100% surety that I remember Brandon saying that. But I think I do. So it definitely has a Jordan feel to it. I mean, it really does. And I don't want to get into picking apart who wrote what, but it's definitely, you know, it's definitely a powerful opening to the book. And I just wonder, didn't we see those black and silver clouds again sometime in the Gathering Storm in some other circumstances?
I think they might be the clouds that appear when Rand visits Moradin later in the book, in the dream sequence. The same sort of mysterious striated clouds that float past the window that appeared in Eye of the World and, you know, have very rarely appeared again since. Yeah. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but maybe not.
I'm still doing my reread of the series. I'm up to Lord of Chaos, so it's not going to be a few months until I get to Gathering Storm, although I think I'm going to have to read it in tandem if we're going to do this actual read-through again. I'm going to have to start it and read it at the same time. That gets a little confusing, but I can do it. So anything else on this particular point of view, gentlemen? I call dibs on Grendel.
Oh, okay. Okay. There is one thing I want to say before we move on, is that these kind of scenes here are what make me believe that there is very little possibility for the Dark Friends and the Forsaken to win. Because we have everyone, well, not everyone, but we have a large portion of the population, the majority of the population of these worlds are not Dark Friends. They may not be as adamant about being Light Friends as, say, the Children of the Light, but they are not Dark Friends who will fight for their land and their freedoms and all this. And the Dark Friends don't have that. They do have limited numbers. We don't think about it so much because we're in the midst of these things and we have everything running in front of our eyes, including these massive amount of Dark Friends that are attacking Matt and Perrin and surrounding Rand, not really attacking him, but we see these masses of them. But when we look beyond that and see the masses of the rest of the people, just the common people who are picking up arms to defend their homes, there's no way for the Dark Friends to win. That doesn't mean that there's no way for the Dark One to win, because he would be able to turn even a victory for the common people into a victory for him if he's scheming and conniving as much as he has to be the Dark One. So I think that there's no possible way for the Forsaken to win, and unless the Dark One can turn a victory for the quote-unquote Light into his own use, to his own purposes, I don't know how that would work either.
I don't believe the Dark One is depending on large masses and armies of Dark Friends, human Dark Friends, in order to win. And I agree that the common people, the regular people that are being caught up in this Severan swirl and you know, the swirl of the pattern toward Tarmogoyne, I agree that they will greatly outnumber the human Dark Friends. But don't forget, the Dark One has many other minions that are even more powerful. He's got Murgrel, he's got Trollocs, he's got Drekkar, he's got, you know, all number of things that we may not have even seen yet. And those, you know, I mean, let's face it, an average, even a trained foot soldier, you know, a Trolloc is probably, you know, capable of taking care of one or two of them unless they're good. You know, two at a time would not be unreasonable if it was just an average recruit like this blacksmith going to try and help save the world, not a trained fighter, not anybody else. I mean, you know, masses of men like that are not trained in battle are, well, in these days, I mean, not these days particularly, but the old days, I mean, they were basically foot soldiers and cannon fodder. They were just numbers. And I don't know if that's going to stack up too well against what the Dark One's going to be able to bring against, you know, against the forces of the Light. And, of course, they're also going to have, you know, their own dreadlords and channelers and so forth and so on, in addition to the Forsaken. And the other thing that kind of bothers me is that we have a number of powerful Light Friends. I'm sort of digressing a little bit here. I beg your pardon. We have a number of powerful people for the Light, you know, Rand, Matt, Perrin, you know, good leaders, Rodol de Tiralde and, you know, Gareth Brand and other people like that. But do we have, how many people do we have that are on the level of power of the Forsaken to general armies? You know, not only good generals, but, you know, one power wielders as well. I think it's going to be a tough fight. It's going to be a difficult battle, and I don't know that, I'm sure the outcome has been determined in the writer's mind, but looking at it from the readership point of view, I think we're looking at a lot of heavy losses if nothing else, so probably going to need all these blacksmiths and borderlanders checking up to the north to contribute their might to what they can.
Well, I'd be more afraid of the Forsaken if they could somehow work cohesively rather than as their own individual unit. But, you know, with a lot of them out of the way now, we have Masana and Demondred and Morden really are the core of what's left. I mean, Halima or Erengar is around somewhere. Mogheedon and Sindane are still around, but they are complete puppets to Moradin. So I think the getting rid of Forsaken that Rand has done, the kind of culling of the Forsaken ranks, has been a good thing for the Chosen, because they are able to get a smaller, more powerful group than its large kind of many-armed, super-segmented coven that they had.
Yeah, I suppose that's true, although I have it in my mind that now that Rand is done for so many of the Forsaken, finally, and you know, well, we assume that Gandalf is absolutely finally taken care of. Simarag, we know, was fail-fired, but there is still a lingering question that Gandalf could have somehow subverted, you know, with the compulsion and everything like that. She should have somehow got around, and I've heard a couple of people bring up really plausible methods that she could have dodged that little bullet. And so she could possibly be still looking around, but assuming that even that she's gone, there's nothing to stop the Dark One from raising up new Dreadlords and new Forsaken. I mean, there are plenty of candidates. I think Mazrim Taim, for one, big one, probably standing right in line to become another Chosen. And there may be others about whom we do not know.
Yeah, and there are theories that Taim has already become another Forsaken, replacing any of the numbers of ones that Rand has ousted.
Yeah. So anyway, back to the topic. I think we've progressed enough for that, and I apologize for asking my fault, as usual.
All right, so we're going to move on now to our next point of view in the prologue, and that is Palendre, the Soldam. And she and her Demone are with Rand and his group after the confrontation with Semerog, where Rand got his hand blown off. Palendre and her charges have been moved via gateway to Ibudar, just on a road outside the city. She is still trying to grasp the idea that Anath was really one of the Forsaken. Rand orders Palendre to take a message to the Daughter of the Nine Moons that he still wants a meeting. He will be in Ered Domain quelling the fight against the Shanshan there. And then they all ride off into the sunset.
That always kind of surprises me that he let all of them go, since he was rounding up Suldam earlier and giving them to Elaine, basically.
Yeah, well, these ones, I can understand it because they're high in status or stature, because they were accompanying people who they believed was, and others believed was, the Daughter of the Nine Moons. So obviously these aren't low-level servants. These are people of power and authority, as much as a Soldam can have power and authority. And so, not only do you want to kind of ease tensions a little bit that way, but you want them to get the message back that you still want to meet with the actual Daughter of the Nine Moons, not a Forsaken who is leading you all along by the nose. The one thing I'm interested about here is that I'm going to admit right now, my bad is that I'm naughty. I haven't actually reread the prologue recently. So I don't remember whether or not Palendre and the Demoni were blindfolded or what, or if the weaves were inverted, but wouldn't they have seen how to weave the gateway if they were moved via gateway to a road outside Ibudar?
No, because if Rand wove it, it would be male work and they wouldn't be able to, and I don't remember them being blindfolded, so I think that's true. Yeah, so unless Nynaeve opened the gateway, or Cadswain, or one of the other...
Yeah,
female channelers, if Rand opened it and moved it, then no, they wouldn't have seen a thing.
Yeah. For some reason, I was assuming that one of the Aes Sedai had been the ones to move him, but you're right, that's more likely something that he would have the Ashaman that were with him do to create the gateways than to have the Aes Sedai.
And we have to assume that Semerog just didn't allow them to be in the vicinity when she wove the gateway, or they could have picked it up from her.
Yeah.
You know, but
well, I don't think Semerog wove a gateway in the first place. I think they met by traditional travel when
she was
impersonating Tuan.
Yeah, of course. You're absolutely right. What was I thinking? Sorry.
Dude. Yeah, and I would assume, well, and we know that Rand gatewayed outside, like I think a hill or two over from the meeting spot, and then rode up on his horse.
Yeah.
One of the things.
Logan was with him too. He could have had Logan open the gateway if he didn't feel up to it.
Actually, I don't remember myself as to who wove the gateway. I know that when it was done, Philandra is thinking to herself that, you know, she had to like resist getting ill because, you know, it just, she was so conscious of there being so many men around that were channeling and how, you know, horribly dangerous everything was. And, you know, her just disbelief that Rand was letting her go because, you know, it was one of those things that just is unthinkable in her mind. Slightly connected, but also a slight digression. The ebook cover for Knife of Dreams has come out, and it actually does bear reference to this particular point of view because the picture that it demonstrates is Rand holding his hand and spear up as Semirog throws the fireball at him and Men. It's a nice image. I don't want to get into our usual art critique of the particular cover at this point in time. Like I said, I think it's a great image. And, but it definitely was one of the things I thought that I would mention since we are talking, you know, about, an incident which happened directly after that.
Yeah, thank you. I was going to bring that up as well because it does sort of have a bearing on it here. There were a couple of interesting things about it, and then you're right, we probably shouldn't get into the art critique. And one thing that a lot of people have already mentioned is that he's wearing a sword on his right hip instead of his left, which makes no sense that he's right-handed. And also, I think the Shanchen spear was pretty wrong because it doesn't look like a spear handle that was cut off. But anyway, it was an awesome, awesome piece of work. And it really, I think, is one of the best depictions of Rand that I think I've seen. And I really liked it. And somebody else pointed out, I can't take credit for this too, but in the image of the fireball that's coming toward Rand, it's actually a really subtle depiction of skull. It's very strange.
I don't think I noticed that.
I didn't see it at first myself. One of the commenters on the post at Dragon Mount picked that out. And you kind of have to look at sort of up at the top of the fireball that's coming towards Rand's outstretched hand with a dragon scepter. And it's not really obvious. You really got to look, but you could make it out. And I can't think that it was unintentional. And once you see it, you can't not see it. And I thought Semirog was great, too. That is hands down the best depiction of Semirog that I think I've ever seen. I'm real happy with that one. I think these people covers are amazing in general.
Yeah.
You know, in general, they are totally amazing. Wish I'd done it.
Yep.
Our third point of view in the prologue is Lieutenant General Tylee Kerghan. She rides her warhorse Duster as her army returns to Abu Dhar days right away. She's pleased that she's lost so few soldiers at Maldon because Perrin's plan worked so amazingly well. Mishima is riding with her. They have been seeing ghosts and do not know what to make of it. Karm, the quartermaster, reported that a pack of rations has turned to dust inexplicably. Tylee worries that they are focusing on the wrong enemy, believing that Galgan and Saroth have a single purpose, at least until the High Lady Tuan unveils herself. She can say nothing of this due to the rigid Shanchen hierarchy. Suddenly, as she is speaking with Mishima, a barbed arrow strikes him, taking him down and killing him, and her party is attacked by hundreds of Trollocs.
Yeah, that was kind of a strange scene. When I read it, I wasn't quite sure what to make of it. I'm sure it'll be significant later on. But again, now we're having more and more people seeing the ghosts and seeing the effects of whatever it is that's happening, the disintegration of the entire universe, if that's possible. And I just sort of point out one of our favorite little themes that, as Jesse's always fond of saying, you know, how would this book go if they all had cell phones? I mean, here's Tylee running around thinking about, you know, the High Lady Tuan unveiling herself. She's completely out of touch. You know, there's no way she could not be. You know, it's kind of scary when you think about how long it takes for them to get information from one to the other.
Yeah. My favorite part of this scene, though, is the fact that, you know, the Shaunshan don't believe that Trollocs exist because they haven't seen them in centuries or however. It's been centuries, hasn't it, since Luther?
I don't think they had Trollocs in Murdral in Shaunshan.
No, they didn't. They didn't. And if they did have them when they originally got there, they've all been wiped out now or something. I can't remember exactly what the history on that is, but they don't believe that they exist. They think they're bedtime stories, much like, you know, Tuan believed of the snakes and foxes when Matt told her about them. And yet, these warriors are so good that they're being confronted with these things from their worst nightmares, quite literally. These things are the stuff of nightmare and scary campfire stories and such in Shaunshan. If they have scary campfire stories, you know, if they're personable enough for that, which I don't know that they are. And yet, they meet them head on. They're not put back so much that a significant portion of their army is decimated. They meet them head on, and as we see later, spoiler for later in the book, as we see later, they survive. And Ty Lee is able to present the head of a Trolloc to Tuan.
Yeah.
So, she is Tuan, yeah, she's still Tuan at that point.
It is an extremely interesting thing in my mind. I can see the cinematic of it all, because for Ty Lee, it has to be one of those almost dream state sequences. I mean, she's sitting there, she's talking with Mishima, and, you know, and he grunts, and suddenly there's like an arrow transfixing his throat, if I remember properly.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, I can see him slumping out of the saddle, and she turns just as this thing with like a wolf's muzzle and ram's horns, wearing giant, you know, huge, you know, tall enough to be able to reach her in the saddle, like barrels out of the underbrush. And, you know, I can see the entire cinematic slow motion sequence of coming out. It does take her a little bit. I know she loses. They fight very well. I know she takes losses in finally getting away from the Trollocs or, you know, defeating them. But it is one of those weird, you know, I can just kind of see that kind of thing happening, particularly in, you know, like either a movie or a TV series. It's something I think could be done really well and could, you know, bring across just, yes, how alien the Trollocs are, because, I mean, a lot of the Shaunshan, they muse about running into or seeing a Trolloc at some point in time, and I think, trying to remember, I want to say it's actually, I don't know if you're, is it Furyk Kareed? No, it wouldn't be.
Yeah, Furyk Kareed.
Well, no, I was thinking more earlier, I'm thinking to even back towards the Great Hunt, I think High Lord Turok actually muses about wondering what would win, a Grom or a Trolloc or something
like
that. And it just, you know, it occurs to me that, you know, these are so disorienting that I can just see that perplexity before, you know, she manages to outsword and actually manage to fend the thing long or off, you know, until it ends up being killed. So, I mean, I think that this is a really neat sequence.
I think that unless my memory serves me wrong, that either Mishima or Ty Lee, and I think it was Mishima, said to Perrin at one point in time, I would really like to see these Trollocs of yours some days. And Perrin just goes, no, you wouldn't. You probably will, but you won't want to see them. Something like that. You know, it's like, no, you don't. You really don't.
And Mishima never did, poor guy.
Yeah, and then I think he got taken down by it. And if I may, I want to just read this one paragraph, because I just happened to be looking at that spot in the book when the Trolloc attacks Tylee. She sees Mishima get the arrow through the throat, and the horse is turned around, and it just saved her life, because basically the Trolloc sword cutting the saddle where Tylee had been sitting as she was unseated by her horse who panicked. So she screams to arms, and turns to fight them. And then, now I'm going to read for just a brief second. And for the first time, she saw just what he was. Not quite a man, instead some creature with twisted features, the head covered in coarse brown hair, the too wide forehead wrinkled with thick skin. Those eyes were disturbingly human-like, but the nose below was flattened like that of a boar, and the mouth jutted with two prominent tusks. The creature roared at her, spittle spraying from its nearly human lips. Blood of my father's forgotten, she thought. What have we stumbled into? The monster was a nightmare, given a body and let loose to kill. It was a thing she had always dismissed as superstition. And then she goes ahead and charges it anyway, knocks its six sword away and manages to kill it. But it's amazing what you can do when you're fighting for your life, but still, you know, she came off a lot better than she could have been taken by surprise by creatures out of nightmare.
Yeah. And I just found the information I was looking for in the white book. It says, it's talking about the exotic animals of Shaunchen, you know, the Grolm and the Raken and the Lopart,
yeah.
All these things.
Yeah.
And it says these strange new creatures were not Shadowspawn at all, but the descendants of beasts brought back from parallel worlds via portal stones during the first 1,000 years after the breaking, probably in an attempt to find aid against the real Shadowspawn. While the creature's effectiveness was not recorded, it was during the same period that all remaining Shadowspawn on the continent were eradicated. So, we know that even before Luthair Pendrag came to Shaunchen, that all the Shadowspawn were taken care of, but the other exotic beasts were kept.
Interesting.
Wait, did you say the first 1,000 years after the breaking?
Yeah,
during the first 1,000 years after the breaking.
So there were Aes Sedai powerful enough to use the portal stones within the first 1,000 years after the breaking.
Yeah, apparently.
Just
well,
really bizarre.
You got to remember that that the Aes Sedai in Shaunchen were not as inhibited as those in Randland. I mean, they not only did they quarrel with one another, and that's kind of what they're known for more is their abuse of their power, but also one of them was willing to experiment and create a new Terangriel, and I don't think that that's an odd thing for them to have done. They were not as whatever you want to call the stupids that became the Aes Sedai that we know and hate today or love today in Radland.
Well, they didn't have all the rules and regulations of the White Tower because they didn't have a White Tower. They were just basically individual random Aes Sedai running around doing whatever they felt like, you know.
Yeah, well, a lot of those things aren't really rules or regulations or even tradition. You know, you can't experiment with the One Power because heaven forbid that you might actually learn stuff. I mean, that you might possibly burn yourself out even though that's kind of rare.
But isn't that interesting too? Isn't that interesting too? These same Aes Sedai that are using portal stones 1,000 years after the breaking are still the same morons that forgot how to travel. Duh. I don't care who argues with me about that. I will never.
Well, we don't know that the Shaunchen Aes Sedai forgot how to travel. We do know that the Randland Aes Sedai did. That somehow that knowledge was lost. And you're right. There is really no logical reason for it, but they're anything but logical. But we don't know that the Shaunchen Aes Sedai did.
Well,
the Shaunchen channelers, I have to say, because really they are not behaving in a way that is, in my mind, Aes Sedai at all. Not even this age's interpretation of Aes Sedai.
In fact, they actually can't be called Aes Sedai because that's a thing of, first of all, the Age of Legends, where they were servants of all, and secondly, the White Tower after that. So, you know, however the channelers evolved in Shaunchen, definitely they were not subject to either the rules of the Aes Sedai pre-Age of Legends or post-Age of Legends. But I can't imagine that they didn't know how to travel if the ones on this side of the continent did. I guess maybe they never discovered it. I don't know. But I just never have gotten over the fact that, you know, right after the breaking, all the Aes Sedai that survived suddenly woke up one morning and go, oh my god, I don't remember how to travel anymore. Oh dear. Should have written that down. Oops. I mean, well, one guy argued with me debated with me about this on the comments in the podcast, and I maintain that, you know, even if they weren't strong enough, if you remember, Soralia learned how to do the weave, and she actually showed it to Casplay. She says, I'm not strong enough to make it work, but I can show you how to do the weave. And Soralia is one of the weakest channelers we've ever seen. I mean, barely, wouldn't even last as a novice. And she was able to demonstrate the weave enough for Cadswain to pick it up. So it isn't necessarily a matter of strength to be able to know the weave just to make it work properly. Anyway, I'm digressing. I'm sorry. I apologize. I'll stop.
No, okay. I mean, my larger incredulity with the concept of them having used portal stones within the 1,000 years after the breaking is that, according to Loyal in The Great Hunt, the use of portal stones required an extremely strong channeler, so much so that it's completely unheard of having been done on the Randland side of things, even, you know, shortly after the breaking. So it's more the idea that even in the Age of Legends, they said some of the truly powerful Aes Sedai were the ones who ended up being able to use the portal stones. And because you had to be like extremely, phenomenally powerful. And I'm kind of surprised that it seems like a whole lot of them apparently showed up in Shanshan and like, hey, there are these things over here that are Trellix and Myrdril. Let's go to weird shifty land and grab ourselves some Grom.
Let's all go to weird shifty land. Okay.
I mean, it is. It seems to me it's like an amazing disparity that we, you know, apparently portal stone dot all over Rand land in like a huge proficiency, and yet there was no one strong enough to, you know, hop into another world. Or maybe that's why the people who, or the people on this side of the ocean forgot to channel, and that is everybody who knew how to channel was also strong enough to use a portal stone, and they hopped themselves to a better world.
I don't know. It doesn't seem to me that they would have been as common as they were if only, you know, the top 1% could actually use them. I have a feeling that, first of all, there were probably a lot more really strong channelers in the Age of Legends, so that what we consider to be extremely extraordinarily powerful post-breaking was probably just above average, you know, in the AOL. So that's kind of my thought about that. I don't think anybody would have made that strong of that superfluity of portal stones for, you know, about 10 guys to use or whatever.
Yeah, well, and, you know, we've seen that we know that a lot of the reason that there aren't that many powerful channelers on this side of the Aerith Ocean, I say this side even though none of us actually live in Randland, but on that side of the Aerith Ocean, is because the Aes Sedai, the Red Aja especially, have been over the centuries and millennia, have been systematically culling the gene pool of channelers.
Yep.
And they are literally cutting the channeling gene out of the human race.
Yep.
Cutting it in half anyway. And the few females that are left, the Aes Sedai have no inclination to ever get married and propagate, and the rest of them are, mostly the rest of them are wilders and or those who have the spark but never learned how to use it.
Well, I have to differ with you in one respect, is that they have been culling the gene out of Aes Sedai in, you know, the common area of Randland, and we've now recently discovered that there are plenty of channelers who haven't had that genetic influence applied to them. You know, we have the Sifo, we've got the Kin, we've got the people in Shara, the Ayad, you know, we've got the Aiel. They haven't been culling themselves. The only thing they do is call the men because the men go crazy. So there is a
that's half of the channeling gene pool,
yeah,
though.
That is important, but it's not as much as what they've done, you know, with the white power.
You see that though. A lot of these other things are, except for the Kin. The Kin are not, because most of them are people who got kicked out of the tower. But the Aiel, the Sea Folk, and the Shanshan, after Luthair Paindrag went over and they started culling the half the gene pool, they are more powerful than the Aes Sedai, because the Aes Sedai are too snooty to ever get husbands and have children. However, they're not as powerful as Rand or the many of the Forsaken, you know, the top tier. We don't know about Shara. I assume, though, that they are not, that they still have that high level of channeling ability, simply because they haven't been culling their population and weeding out half of, they keep the men around to breed off of, not even,
so 20 something,
yeah, to tell their 20 something, breed them as like cattle, and then send them away.
Yeah. No, kill them. They just kill them.
Yeah, yeah.
I have to differ with you on one aspect, is that actually the Shanshan are culling as well, and they are not noticeably stronger than the Aes Sedai over here, because they're not allowing the Sul'dahm to breed, and they're killing the men who can channel. So they're culling too. They're probably seeing
allowing the Demani. They're not allowing the Sul'dahm either?
I don't think they allow the Sul'dahm or the Demani to breed, do they? Maybe when the Sildar retire,
well,
they can.
I'm not sure if it's so much the fact that they don't allow it as the fact that there's no one who can be a male at as high a status as a Sildar, or at the right level as a Sildar would be.
Yeah,
and
well,
I think that's
getting,
more of what it is than
they're culling all the women with the Fark out by making them Dimani, and they never could breed. And then,
yeah.
So the only ones that are left that might possibly, after they retire, would be the Sildar, and they're only the ones who could be caught channel.
Yeah.
And then we've got
people like Aliva, who is as powerful as Lanfear was. We assume that Sindane was Lanfear.
Yeah.
And so, that just does not compute in my mind.
Well, I just think she's a fluke, just like Nynaeve and Elaine. And I would just assume that the pattern is throwing up more powerful channelers despite the genetics because they're needed. You know, they're needed. And Tavirin draw to them what they need. So, the pattern has to make them. I mean, he can draw everything he wants to, but if the pattern doesn't start them out before they're, you know, 20 years before they're needed, then they're not going to be old enough to do any good. So, you just have to figure that it's all part of the design in some respect. And, we sort of digressed a little bit, but then the other thing is that we have considered, and I've never really heard anybody mention this, is that despite the fact that the Red Aja is culling out men who can channel, they're only culling out men who can channel who actually start channeling and decide to show it. They are not finding any of the men, like all the guys that showed up at the Black Tower, like Dahmer Flynn and Jura Grady and stuff. Some of these guys were old, and they could be taught to channel, and they're reproducing. And those guys have got to be salted all throughout both Sean Chan and Grand Van Society because they never get caught. Unless they just wake up and say, hey, I want to learn to channel, and there's no method for them to do that until Rand started the school. The only channelers that the Red Aja were finding were like the women like the Dimani, the guys who had the spark and started to do it. So, yeah, I guess they're not calling out as much as we thought, huh?
Yeah, and I don't know what the genetics is, whether it's more or less likely to have a channeler along your line based on whether or not you have the spark as opposed to you can learn to channel eventually if you have the proper teaching.
I'm not sure how that works either, if it's a slightly separate gene on the allele on a gene series or if it's just a matter of strength. In other words, you're going to show it. If you're going to be that strong, you're going to show it and have the spark. If you're not as strong, I don't know. I'm not sure how that works out either, but I mean, I think that it's probably just a straight recessive, you know. Otherwise, everybody who would channel would be producing people right, left, and center. So it's just got to pop up in families when the gene combines one from each side, you know.
Yeah, it almost seems like it's kind of a mutation rather than an actual gene. Like, rather than a gene that produces blue eyes, it's more of a kind of gene that creates a common mutation.
No, I don't think that we need to have, I don't think we need to postulate a mutation. I think standard, you know, Mendelian genetics will take care of that because, I mean, there's no bias against blue eyes or anything like that. So they're plenty common in a lot of societies. If it was a dominant gene, then a person who channeled would have to have a parent who was a channeler or could be taught to channel. And we see that that's not true. So we have to assume that it's just a standard recessive. And recessives, you know, they can hide for generations. Because you have to have one parent, each parent to manifest an offspring with a recessive. Each parent has to have that recessive gene, but they're not necessarily going to play it. You know, they may carry it for generations, but they won't necessarily show it. But then when two get together that both carry that recessive, then you get it. So it can show up in every generation or it can hide from several.
Yeah, you would know better than I. My knowledge of genetics is basic high school biology.
I raised dogs. Okay, I'll give you a quick little simile and then we got to get back on track. But my very first fox terrier was a black and white fox terrier. Black and white is recessive and my breed to tan and white. She came from a long line of like five generations of tan and whites on both sides. We went through pedigrees to try and find out where the black and whites came. And we found in the fifth and fourth generation, one on each side that was black and white, and that was it. And suddenly in this litter of four puppies, two black and white ones came up. All those generations, five generations of fox terriers, not one single black and white popped up. It just happened to get one of each, one parent, Byron Dam had that recessive, and 50% of the puppies were black and white. But they had been all been carrying down that gene, or not all of them, but some of them had been carrying that gene for 4 and 5 generations without producing it because the other parent didn't happen to have it. Or sometimes they might happen to have it, and you're just the luck of the draw, you don't get it. I mean, the statistics are only for large populations, so even if you expect to see it in 50% of the dogs or people or whatever it is, if you're only going to have a litter of 3 or 4, you know, sometimes it's just like sometimes you have 4 girls and sometimes you have 4 boys, and statistically you ought to have 2 and 2. It just works out that way. You know, it's populations are what the statistics apply to, not, you know, individual people or litters. So I think we can explain the channeling as just a straight recessive. I don't think that we need to make an imitation. But the IAD have got it down pat. You know, they allow only, the channelers are only allowed to breed to other channelers, and that's going to maximize the number of channelers that you produce and theoretically increase the strength of some channelers when they are produced.
Okay, now I got a challenge for you. Explain how people become magicians in Harry Potter.
It's genetic. Same thing, recessive. When you have a group of people like, okay, the wizards, you know, if it's a recessive gene and they tend to stay in their own family and just marry other wizards, that just makes it even more likely that that's all you're going to get, because pretty soon everybody's got that gene, at least on one side and usually both. Because in order to be a wizard, you would have to have, that's all you could have would be those 2 recessive genes. You couldn't just carry it. Probably the squibs are the ones that just somehow managed to get only one of the genes and not others. Okay, I happen to have bred a dog that was an extremely popular sire who was black and white. When I first started in the breed 25 years ago, the vast majority of the sleuths in the country of the United States were tan and white, and the recessive was almost non-existent. I happened to breed a dog whose father was black and white, and then when I bred that dog to one of my own, I got a black and white sire, and he was used extensively. And there were 1 or 2 other dogs that were also black and white, and we basically, in 10 years, almost eliminated the tan and white gene from the gene pool, because you have to be tan and white to produce one. This is like the brown eyes as opposed to the blue eyes, or the non-channelers as opposed to the channelers. And it isn't that hard to eliminate a dominant gene, because it only takes one gene to show it, but if you've got it, that's what you are. It's obvious, okay? Whereas the recessive, you can be carrying the recessive gene and not show it. So it's really hard to call that out. All you can do is call out the ones that actually have it from both partners and show it, like the blue eyes. You can get rid of brown eyes really easily. Just breed blue eyes to blue eyes indefinitely, and that's all. After a couple of generations, that's all you'll get, unless you bring in some outside stock that has brown eyes. It's not the same with the blue eyes. You could sit there and breed brown-eyed people to brown-eyed people forever, and you'd still pop up with some blue-eyed ones once in a while. You'd cut the frequency down a lot, but it still happens. Unless you get some genetic test for it, you know, where you can take a blood sample and tell that they're carrying that gene. There's no way to know that they are. So anyway, here's my, now that I've totally lost all of, now I've totally lost all of our audience completely and irrevocably.
Yeah, a lot of this can be cut. This is just for us to talk to each other.
I don't know. I think it's pretty cool, but it probably would bore everybody.
And it's kind of interesting to think that someone like, Hermione, I guess, the muggle-born witch or wizard, has to have a squib along both lines somewhere.
Well, both of her parents were muggles, but obviously they each carried a wizarding gene, and she popped up with it from both sides, so she's a witch.
Yeah, so both of her parents, somewhere in their ancestry, have to have a squib.
Yeah.
Which means that they have to have an actual wizarding family.
Or, yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are wizards who married outside, or maybe, you know, maybe they played around and had some illegitimate kids and just never mentioned anybody, and that, you know. I mean, just because somebody stays in their families, you know, and just marries in families doesn't eliminate that gene from the rest of the gene pool. It just concentrates within that family. Obviously, for there to have been wizards in the first place, or in Oranland channelers, there always had to be some channelers. You know, so there always had to be some wizards around. It wasn't until they decided to all go underground and hide that then they stayed all in their families that they really concentrated in their lines and hardly ever got squibs. I would have to say that if anything was a mutation-sounding thing to me, it might be the squibs, because the fact that wizards are tending to marry wizards, so pretty soon nobody's got a non-wizarding gene to pass on, unless they're the milkman's kid or something, you know. I mean, you always have to allow for that stuff, no matter what you're looking at when you're talking about populations.
Human populations, anyway.
Well, no, you know, you can get that horse
dog
jump.
Population.
No, you can get that dog jump over the fence and have his way with your girl, you know.
That's why you put them in a cage, not in a fence.
Well, they can't live in a cage all the time. I mean, I'm saying, nature wants to do what it wants to do, and if a horse or a dog can jump a fence and get to something that's new and different, they'll do it. Anyway. Onward.
Anyway, talking about reproduction. Talking about reproduction. Guess what? We're going on to Grendel now.
We're talking about, I missed that. It broke up.
Talking about reproduction, we're going on to Grendel now.
And why does Grendel have anything to do with reproduction?
It's mostly the process by which it's achieved.
Because she has huge tracts of land.
Okay. I think that went right over my head. Maybe it's because I didn't hear it properly. I don't know. Anyway. So, on to the next point of view, which happens to be one of the fabulous Forsaken, Grendel. And we open with Grendel lounging in her palace amidst her pet. A gateway opens, and Mila picks out Sarasa, one of the Damani Council of Merchants that she's acquired as a pet. She just ranges far and wide and gets all these poor innocent people to be her little. And then through the gateway, a messenger enters. Grendel thinks that he must be from Morden, as Salmiel was the only other one who knew exactly where she was, and she is convinced that Salmiel died in the struggle with Randall Thor. The messenger then takes her back through the gateway into Blackstone Fortress in the deep northeastern Blight. She does not understand why Morden is so focused on killing the other two boys, Matt and Perrin, instead of Rand. The Mandred and Masana enter. She knows that Masana is in the White Tower because she gets information from the agents in the White Tower and also from Irengar with the rebels. Morden spends his time gathering forces for the last battle while Morgideon and Sindane rally Dark Friends to kill Matt and Perrin. Grendel knows that Semirog is with the Shantan, so she believes that she knows the plans for everyone except the Mandred. It really aggravates her. She thinks that she would have heard from her spies if they... She thinks that she would have heard from her spies by now if he were there with the Borderlanders. Morden enters. Masana and Demondred have asked for this meeting in order to ask for help in freeing Semirog. Masana had a woman spy at the meeting. Morden says that Semirog failed to capture Randall Thor and disobeyed orders in the process, harming him, so there is to be no rescue. He flexes his left hand, which indicates that there is a connection. Maybe the Great Lord will find some use for her, he says. Masana reports that the White Tower is nearly broken. Demondred reports that his rule is secure. Morden then dismisses them, except for Grendel, and tells her that her presence was her reward for good work. He tells her that Rand is coming to Erebor to restore order, and her orders are to prevent that from happening. She is not to harm him, but to bring him pain of heart, frustration, and anguish. So what do you think?
Well, so my first thought
everywhere.
Is,
Grendel's got spies everywhere, didn't he? Go ahead, your first thought is?
My first thought is that, it was really weird. When we saw Masana in here, she looked unduly concerned about the state of Semirog. I mean, she's more concerned than she should have been for a fellow Forsaken, even one that she's in league with. I mean, we see Demondred, who's in the same boat that Masana's in, is cool as a cucumber, and you have Masana, who's almost, for her, especially for Forsaken, is freaking out. Is having a breakdown over the fact that Semrog's been caught. And I cannot understand why Masana is acting the way she is.
Well, I think there might be two reasons for that. One is that I think it really scares her that one of the Forsaken can be so easily abandoned to captivity, because let's face it, she's on pretty thin ice herself. And the other thing is that maybe there's something going on that we just don't know about, that maybe even Demondred doesn't know about. I mean, I don't know. I mean, they've got all these other little sub-alliances and everything. I mean, look at Erengar trying to cuddle up with Grendel to get her to ally with her and everything. There's probably something else going on that we don't even know. You know, maybe she had some key to some puzzling question that we don't know about. Yeah, I thought this would be one of the most interesting sections, but nobody has anything to really say. I mean, it's the closest thing to Forsaken Tea Party that we get all the time here.
Yeah, and you know, there is always the question, even that Grendel asked here, is why did Moradin invite her to come and watch this? I mean, what was his game here? Because he obviously had one.
Yeah.
Well, I'm also kind of interested, and we'll get into this later, and I'm making a note now to bring it back up the further we progress in our recap. But Moradin instructs her to bring Rand, like, pain of heart, frustration and anguish. And I'm kind of, I don't know, it's really weird because the frustration, the pain, and the anguish that I see him going through don't seem to necessarily be the result of her in any way, shape, or form. And they end up being really cathartic for him. So much so that we've, you know, determined in previous podcasts that, you know, he's made an actual, you know, if not permanent, at least a temporary turnaround in his original state.
Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of...
Because, I mean, we don't really even see her doing anything that seems to suggest that she's trying to cause him mental anguish.
But maybe, you know, I mean, he went after her first. I mean, maybe that was because he found out where she was and didn't know where anybody else was. But, you know, he did his famous, you know, now the birds are singing and you're going to die routine on her. So there must have been something going on there.
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, it also comes down to Grendel is kind of touted as being one of the most subtle and devious. I mean, it's the Forsaken. And it's really interesting here because, I mean, we get another summation of where Demandred is located because it still has, of, you know, the 12th book has not been ever released. You know, it's not been described anywhere where Demandred is stationed. But, you know, he claims here, you know, my forces are secure. You know, and basically, or my rule is secure. Which is really a very strong and commanding statement, which means he's either just lying boldly, or he does actually have, you know, a foothold somewhere and a controlling stake in one of the world's major factions. So,
yeah.
You know, it is kind of one of those, you kind of get to be in her head just enough to kind of see, you know, well, I know where Mesaana is, and I know where, you know, Arengar is, and, you know, I don't think he's in the Borderlands, because I think I would have heard about it by now, but don't really know where Demandred is. So.
Well, I think his rule is probably using Taim as a proxy and basically controlling the Ashaman that are the ones that have been, you know, tainted by his special classes and so forth that Mazrim Taim is getting. I really do believe, I mean, I know Demandred is not Taim, there's no Taimandred, but I do think that, you know, he's always said, Salmael said he always liked using proxies, and I think that's what Taim is. Taim's being run by Demandred, and probably having been given the promise that if he does really well, he will ascend to be one of the new Dread Lords, if not one of the Forsaken.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. For the most part, trying to remember, there was some other thought. The other thought that I had in this particular section is that this particular Forsaken Tea Party is actually taking place in the Northern Blight, one of these weird Blight towers, and it didn't get really brought up in the mentioning in our you know general read through of what happened in the chapter, but they make. She looks out the window and she notices the farmers or farm constructs or whatever they are that are working on creating new blight resistant strains of crops. And, you know, and for a moment, and I'm not 100% certain on this because, again, I haven't, like, read the prologue in thorough detail since the last time I did. And, I wanted to almost say that something in my mind seemed to indicate that this particular Blight Tower might have actually been north of Shanshan and not north of regular Randland. I might be completely wrong about that, and if I am, then I wanted to say that she identified it as being in, like, the extreme northwest. And, you know, my mind made the logical leap that since the Blight stretches all the way across the world and is, in fact, above Shanshan as well, that it may have actually been up there, but maybe I'm just, you know, kind of thinking to myself, you know, hey, let's make the most crazy possible connection I can.
Yeah, I know. That's a distinct possibility. It doesn't really say anything other than the northeastern Blight, but I guess the Blight isn't as prominent in Shanshan as it is in Randland. I think RJ said that. And I think it shows in the White Book, too, doesn't it?
Yeah, the map shows the Blight stretching all the way across. If I can get to my White Book right here next to me. Not that, you know, my turning in the White Book to the map will result in anyone else being able to see through my eyes, but...
That's okay. Just transmit it telepathically to all of us. And it'll work.
Oh, wait. The colors are swirling. The colors are swirling. I can see it. I can see it.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, we all know that nothing picks up brainwaves better than online audio recording software.
So did you find the page yet?
Oh, I'm still looking for it. I know there's a modern day world map somewhere in this book. Oh, there it is.
Somewhere over the ocean, darling.
So yeah, there is, according to the map on the Big White Book page 146, for those of you listening who may not be familiar with the term Big White Book, the book in question is The World of Robert Jordan's Wheel of Time by Robert Jordan and Teresa Patterson. Actually, I've heard recently that it may no longer be in print, so it may actually be hard to find it in regular bookstores, although I think I've seen at least one or two that still are carrying it in my local area, so
I was able to get it recently used. But on Amazon, and it's in great condition for being used.
Yeah, I got one on eBay when I lost mine, so you can get them. But I mean, they're not sold out because apart from the fact that it's got a lot of great information in it, it's probably partly because it's the worst artwork ever.
So, incidentally, it's really interesting. So on page 146, there is a very small map in which there are both southern and northern ice caps, obviously. Randland itself, as we know it, is mostly above the equator. The land of Madman is kind of a weird, like, Australia-ish sort of continent way to the south of Randland, but on its side of the, or on the eastern side of the world, as the map is showing it currently. And, the Blight, there is a section that says the Blight over both Randland and Shanshan, which spans essentially the width of that particular continent above, well, actually I have no way of telling what the, you know, latitude or longitudes of these are, so, because there's no real referencing point there. 1, 2, 3, 4, around 5 to 6 squares up from the equator.
Well, if you're done, then let me go on before I forget what I was talking about. I think we do need to address what I think is one of the most, and probably a lot of people think is one of the most significant little pieces in this whole prologue, really, the apparent connection, again, between Rand and Moradin, where Rand has lost his left hand, and Moradin flexes his left hand when he thinks about it, you know, so he's apparently physically connected. Now, why he's not emotionally connected, and he's okay to cause Rand pain, anguish, and misery and frustration, you would think that Moradin would get some leakage from that too, but apparently not. Apparently it's just a straight one-on-one physical connection. Or he's just so, you know, alpha personality that he can just, you know, blunt aside whatever emotions Rand's feeling because, you know, maybe it functions like the order Aes Sedai bonds, you know, where they can tell kind of what the other's feeling, but they can block it out because it's not that, you know, demanding of a thing. So what do we make out of this connection between Rand and Mordor? We've seen more and more evidence of this, you know, them becoming aware of each other, actually the colors swirling, actually being aware of one another. You know, that this speaks to maybe eventually one connection where they could actually communicate, sort of like I think that maybe Rand, Matt, and Taren may be able to do with the colors swirling down the road.
Well, we already have seen them use it to communicate. Mind you, it was, they were both dreaming. Dreaming with a capital D, I think. But they were able to use the connection to talk with each other, to actually have a nice, kind of civil conversation compared to the Rand that we have been seeing recently.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and it's interesting, as we will probably mention again at the end of the episode, a lot of the basis for these chapter summaries actually comes from the summaries given for each chapter provided by Encyclopedia Watt. Wonderful, wonderful resource for Wheel of Time referencing. And some of them...
That's encyclopedia-watt.org.
Yes.
And we do thank them greatly and appreciate, well, they actually haven't given us permission. we're using them as a resource, and we do constantly use them as a resource. And basically, these summaries are pretty much 100% from the chapter summaries that they posted online.
Edited somewhat and kind of cut down because...
some of them are, but some are, yeah.
Well, also, I mean, I do know that they are such extensive notes on and summaries of chapters that they go into great detail about the names of every horse that everybody is riding. When there are like 16 people riding in the chapter, you get not only the person, but what each person's horse is named. And sometimes we just have to cut those things out because while they're all interesting details and all wonderfully, you know, minutely realized details, sometimes in reading through them for the purpose of doing a recap like this, some of that needs to hit the cutting room floor. So, use their Encyclopedia Watts summaries, but they are edited for listener sanity.
Yeah, they mentioned all of the Damani, but the reason they do that is because online, obviously, they're linking to an entry for each named character. So, you know, yeah, in order to do that, they have to list off all the names of the Damani that appear in that chapter.
Yeah.
So it's very useful in its way, but, you know, you probably didn't really need to know tonight the name of the six Damani that were with the Calendri and her crew.
Sorry.
But yeah, we do cut a lot out because otherwise we end up with things kind of like this.
The guardsmen bring Armilla, Nain, and Elenya before Elaine. Not Elenya. Yes, they bring Luthorin's dead wife. yes, indeed. Continuing my thought, one of the other things Encyclopedia Watt does with their chapter summaries is provide with a number of little annotations when something is important. It is pointed out here, particularly in connection with Morden giving the order not to physically harm Rand, is the question as to why Rand isn't to be physically harmed. And, you know, is it because there is a direct correlation that he feels the physical pain that Rand feels? And that is why, you know, he's just trying to save himself from feeling every concussion and other things that, you know, seem to happen when Rand gets severely damaged as he, you know, slides further and further down the scale of having parts.
So is Morden going to feel, a lot more upbeat now that Rand isn't so down? Rand's kind of over some of his horrible madness and insanity. Is this going to have a positive effect on Morden and Shamiel?
Well, I don't know. Because that goes back to the can he or can he not feel the emotional turmoil that Rand is in. Because if he can,
and he literally empathizes with Rand, then yes, we're going to see a much more lighthearted Moradin. Although I'm not sure that being lighthearted would make him lighthearted, because it seems that death and blood and destruction make him lighthearted. I don't know. He's kind of crazy.
A little. He's been crazy through several incarnations that we know of.
Well, and it's also a very interesting little bit here. I kind of got that flash where Rand and Luce Thurin are going through, and like their memories start getting so confused, where Luce Thurin's thinking to himself, "Yes, I remember climbing the apple trees and stuff." And Rand's like, "That was me. That wasn't you. That was me." And he's like, "And I don't remember doing this and this because that couldn't have happened. I've never been to these weird places I've never heard of before."
Right.
So I'm suddenly imagining Rand, or not Rand, but Moradin, suddenly going, "Yes, I should climb the apple tree and get in." What the heck?
Yeah, Moradin suddenly has this fantasy of hurting sheep.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know
yet. If
Moradin
captures the fulfill.
Sorry.
What's that?
I was going to say. Go ahead.
Okay. And then we don't know yet if Men's vision of the two becoming one, the two guys merging and one survives and the other, is the other dead or is it just gone? I don't even remember.
Because
I don't remember if it's two merge, and one new being is brought because of it, or if it's two merge and one dies and the other survives.
I thought she said one dies, because she was all upset and worried about it. That it might be him, be the one that dies. She couldn't tell which one. She could only tell that, he merged, in her vision, he merged with another man and only one of them survived. She didn't know which one.
Yeah, and we don't know if that's come to pass yet. We don't know if the revelation on Dragonmount is the fulfilling of that viewing. And
no,
so
no.
It could be that it's supposed to be Rand and Moradin that fulfill that particular viewing of hers.
Well, that's what I think. I've sort of been saying that for a while. That's my crazy theory, and I was poo-pooed that, you think that the major protagonist and antagonist in the series are going to merge together? Okay. But, yeah, I think it's possible. I originally thought it would be Rand and Luce Thurin, but apparently Luce Thurin is not really merged with him and integrated with him. He's basically gone now. So I don't know where that leakage of the past life is coming through or why it even stopped when he started feeling better about himself, but there you are.
Well, it kind of seemed to me, and this is just my own interpretation, well, you know what, never mind. We'll get to that when we get there.
Okay.
Yeah. Getting back onto this portion of the prologue, is this the first time that we've seen Mesaana after she got she got the punishment from Shaed Aharon?
Yes.
Yes, I think the Super Fade had a little session with her, and then we didn't see her again for a while until now.
Yeah.
I think she was referred to, I think, as having looked really, pale and wan and not herself, but I don't think we actually heard anything from her point of view. I can't imagine that was any kind of fun, whatever he did to her.
No. And I had to wonder, besides, the obvious, what else was done in the way of punishment? Because, we've seen Mogh Hedain, when she got punished, she got her soul trapped in a Korsuva. Mind you, her infraction was a whole lot more severe in the eyes of the Dark One. But what can break, because you see, the way she's acting in this section, she has been broken. So what could break a Forsaken that way? Besides the rape.
I think that would probably do it. The tender attentions of a murderer are not something I think I'd ever want to experience. They say people lose their sanity real quick in that situation.
And that's why there are no female Myrdal.
I don't know if they ever produce any female Myrdal. I think they're just like, mules or something like that. They just tend to pop up the one thing, pretty much.
Yeah, there's only ever males.
Yeah.
when there is the throwback to human thoughts from the Trolloc offspring, they're male.
I don't know why they wouldn't be some females, but apparently not.
Could you imagine mydrel babies?
No, it would be too creepy, so I think that they just aren't any, you know.
Well, there has to be, unless they come out of their Trolloc mothers full grown.
No.
In which case, they would have to rip and tear their way out of the womb.
Ew. No, you're right. They probably are the adult children if they come from Trollocs. Where's all the Trolloc children? You know, if they're reproducing and breeding these Trollocs right, left, and center, and pawning off the occasional Murdral throwback, where have they got all these little kid Trollocs?
Well, I know that there's at least 6 or 7 of them that are very worried that Randall Thor killed their daddy in book 1.
I know, Nardby. Yeah, right. Where are they? Have they got, like, school for Trollocs sitting up in the light somewhere?
They're full grown now and out for blood.
This time it's personal.
I'm gonna get me some of that dragon blood.
He's gonna wish he was reborn. He's gonna think he's been reborn. That always reminds me of Nynaeve's threat to herself when she thought she'd seen Birgit in the Two Rivers ducking behind the building, and she thinks to herself, "I'll thump you so you think you had an adventure."
One of my grand thoughts was that Trollocs have to be somewhat like the Jem Hutar from Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and no Trolloc is actually over the age of 6. And therefore, all of the Trolloc babies from Eye of the World were actually the Trollocs who ended up getting killed in the Stone of Tyr.
Okay. So they just grow up really fast. Oh, they grow up so fast these days.
Yeah, they just
like
don't know where the Trollocs are getting
like
their catcher spell white.
It's like the Koloss from Mistborn. They're born with all their skin, and they grow into it, and then out of it.
Yeah, that's gross. Oh, well, we never seen any female Trollocs.
And they grow
either.
Quickly.
Never seen any female Trollocs either, have we? Not one.
We've never been close enough to the Trollocs to know whether or not they're male or female. They're too busy trying to kill our characters.
Maybe they're sort of like the Aiel, and, you know, it's kind of tough to tell when they're all accoutred for a war.
When they're all attacking
you,
you can't really check the parts.
Don't really want to.
As a nod to cinematics everywhere, it's true you don't see many Trolloc women. But they're still like in appearance and speech that...
They all have beards.
And this, of course, has given rise to the notion that there are no Trolloc women. That the Trollocs just spring out of holes in the ground. Which, of course, is preposterous.
I fell off my horse. I meant to do that. We don't get too many Lord of the Rings crossovers here, do we? But, which is kind of surprising when you think about it.
Well, we tend to make them when we're making direct references to what a character is like in deference to other literature. Like, there was an entire thing where we compared, what was it, Loghain was like Boromir or something. Like, we were going through entire lists of characters, and what would this character be if he were in the Lord of the Rings? And, you know, we're going through it, like, you know, Sam was the weird Gandalf role, but sort of, and sort of not. And so was Moraine. It was all very bizarre. So it seems like we always reference Lord of the Rings when we're trying to make a comparison to something else. Just like, oh, look at that.
Yeah.
That is Star Wars.
Hey, does anyone else think it's odd that our Gandalf character is actually a combination of Moraine and Tom? Fishy.
I know. Well, I don't think it's any coincidence of how Merlin's name is Merlin, so similar to Merlin either.
Yeah.
Quark,
and they actually Bush Randall Thor, there's no relation to Arthur. We had an Archer Hawkling, so I don't know where you're going with that, but
Well, and Arthur Hawkwing was High King.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, clearly, Arthur Hawkwing was the Arthurian king of reference, you know, but there was no evidence of Merlin or Tom Merlin in his story. Yeah.
He was opposed to his Merlin, because it was the Amerlin.
Yeah. The anti-Merlin.
Yep.
Anyway, we should move on.
Or the Merlinians. The Merlinians. Oh, my God. We've got a whole new thing now that we can throw in there. We got the Sorcerer's Apprentice now, you know.
I need to watch that.
You should. Nick
so, Spencer, do you
want to...
I want to do Massima. That's all I'm going to say.
All right.
Oh,
I can do two in a row if you want, but I got to do Massima.
That's
okay.
Fine. Having returned from our digression, we continue our progress through the prologue with the point of view of Rodel Itrald. He is preparing to face a Shanshan army of 150,000 outside of the city of Dardaluna. One of his officers is Leedrin. Jalam Nisura was killed in one of his last engagements. Itrald's soldiers are dressed as farmers to fool the Shanshan. Itrald would have thought Dardaluna a grand city before he went to fight the Aiel at Tar Valon. The Shanshan army, of course, falls into the trap, and Itrald attacks. This is just one of those really nice scenes where we actually get to see strategy and combat, and in some ways, guerrilla tactics, similar to what we saw where Matt's rather inferior numbered forces ended up taking out several Shanshan patrols through similar using the crossbows and, you know, setting up a pitfall sort of trap. And one of the great things I think in this was Rodel thinks to himself at how the Rockan are able to see a whole lot, but from the air, people working in the fields look like people working in the fields. They don't look like a bunch of soldiers hunched over with their weapons all in the furrows next to them. You know, they look like some guy laboring over, you know, crops, and how they also miss things like the contents of people inside buildings.
Yeah, they couldn't see inside a building.
So yeah.
And the fact that the entire army behind them is comprised of farmers and, you know, just common everyday men.
Exactly. I mean, it is a very well thought out and calculated plot, and it's building the reputation, because we've heard a number of times, but only once or twice before really gotten to see that Rodel Itrald was one of the great captains, along with Gareth Bryn, formerly with Pedro Niall. And, you know, there were a couple others, and their names.
Cord Aglamar.
Yeah, Aglamar and, Davram Bashir.
Yeah.
And, you know, just, it's nice when we see these people who are supposed to be these great, you know, strategists and generals actually getting to fulfill their roles. So I was really happy with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, we really haven't gotten to see that much. I mean, we've seen a little bit of Bashir doing it in the fight in Ilion against the Shanshan. But I think that's really the only place that we've seen the major generals fighting, actually commanding, we've actually seen them commanding their army. The only other place that we've seen similar things is with Matt. And he's not in amongst that group yet, because he's still kind of an unknown in the land. But yeah, you're right, to actually see one of the great captains doing actually in action and commanding their armies and pulling these sorts of maneuvers off is absolutely amazing. And especially, I love, like you said, I love the logic that he brings into it. Yes, your Rockans are great scouts, but they can only look down. And they can only see so much.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, they can't see through the buildings. They don't have eagle eyes. Your scouts on top of the Rockan don't have eagle eyes. They have human eyes. So they can only see, yep, there's people down there, and that settlement looks safe. Yep, we're good.
Yeah, one of the things I'd like to bring up here, too, I was reading through some of the annotations I want to say either for the end of the Mistborn trilogy or for the beginning of Warbreaker on Brandon's website. And
don't give a spoiler.
I'm actually not going to talk about anything in the books themselves on this particular instance. But what Brandon was saying, if I'm remembering properly, and I don't have it to hand to read through, was that as a writer, sometimes it's really hard to balance these types of battle sequences and get the play of everything that's going on, because, you know, you don't want it to be, you know, a sequence to be battle, because it gets old and repetitive really quick. But at the same time, you want to highlight your principal characters and show what that they're capable of using skills, they're capable of using thought. And it's really nice to see that. I mean, this is obviously a conscious decision. We need Rodel to display why he is as famous as he is on the field of combat, and not directly showing everything that happens in the battle. I think it's in deference to the fact that we will later come back to Rodel following the battle. We don't see the whole battle. We see the lead up to it. We see maybe the beginning of it, and then we see the aftermath. And, you know, how that works in the writing frame of mind is really nice.
Yeah. And it was actually a part, not last year, but the year before last, the first time that Jesse and I interviewed Brandon, that we did in a really crowded Starbucks, and the sound quality was just abysmal. And I still would have probably used it even so. But after we got done doing that little extra bit later on, it was talking about battles and how to write battle scenes and so forth, and Brandon asked us not to use most of it because he felt it would be too revealing for some other things that he was writing, which I presume was the end of Mistborn and Warbreaker. So in deference to his request, it would not be heard. But it was pretty cool because he was talking about exactly that sort of thing, battles and how to write them and how different people interact with them. And, you know, it was pretty neat. How to write a battle scene was a big focus of it, and how Robert Jordan treated battle scenes as opposed to how other authors do it and so forth and so on. It was kind of cool. So there's a little tease for you, sorry.
Well, maybe once books are out, we'll get permission to go back and use that particular segment later.
Yeah, I'm hoping so, because it was pretty nice. It was short and very noisy in the background, but it was pretty cool. So.
Yeah, and I really like kind of the moment that this sets us up for, you know, later in a later chapter when we get back to the aftermath. I kind of like the moment that this sets up where Rodel is talking to the captain of the Shanshan armies and just their little moment there,
right,
and the mutual respect that they have for each other as leaders, even though one has bested the other.
Right. You know, they respect the warrior and each other enough to, you know, appreciate what they've done, even if they lost, you know, and I think that's kind of a code of conduct that's sort of similar in most cultures. And you're right, this is a scene that basically just serves to set us up for a more important scene later on, so I think we can probably move on with that one. So next we have the point of view of Basima Nagar.
Our final point of view for the prologue is the Prophet Basima. The Prophet and his remaining followers, less than 100, scramble up a cliff, fleeing the area of Maldon. He is convinced that Perrin is a shadow spawn. The Lord Dragon appeared to him last night and ordered him to kill Perrin. The Prophet sent his best tool, Aram, to do the job, but he failed. Now the Prophet plans to escape from Perrin and rebuild. Then he's surprised his Fael and her Cha-Fael followers are waiting in the clearing at the top of the cliff. Fael orders her bowmen to fire. The Prophet is wounded and the rest of his men are slain. Fael walks up and stabs Masima in the heart while she orders her followers to make sure that Perrin does not find out. And as he dies, he thinks to himself, Masima, that had been his name. He'd earned his sword on his 15th birthday. His father had been so proud. It's over then, he thought, unable to keep his eyes open. He closed them, falling as if through an endless void. Did I do well, father, or did I fail? There was no answer. And he joined with the void, tumbling into an endless sea of blackness.
Yes! No more mystery.
The prophet is dead! The prophet is dead! Ding dong! The prophet's dead! Which old witch? Yeah. The prophet, the wicked prophet, whatever.
No one doesn't translate easily on the fly.
Yeah, well, the old tongue's like that, what can I say?
This part of the prologue, which I should have mentioned at the very beginning of our... The title of the prologue is What the Storm Means.
Oh, yeah.
But,
the prologue? Imagine!
One of my favorite things about this, in reading this segment, was, and this was echoed later, I think we were talking in a podcast, wherein, at the moment that, you know, hello, Massima, a quiet voice said, he spins around as Fahil, and then, you know, feels like, kill them. You know, and then walks up and twists, you know, the knife, you know, in Massima, you know, and kills him.
Finishes.
It's just the moment where I went, you know what? For everything you have previously done that has irritated the living daylights out of me, Fahil, I forgive you.
I know.
It was such a wonderful moment where I was like, yes! Thank you!
Thank you.
And it's such a necessary thing, and in this moment I can see that Fahil is her mother's daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh yeah.
And Abrams too. I mean, you know, there's some puppies behind her. I had the exact same reaction. I basically at that moment in time forgave Fahil for every annoying thing she ever did or said, and she moved up considerably in my estimation after that. She might actually now be worthy of Perrin, although if Perrin would only stop whining, he might be worthy of her. But yeah, that's one of the great scenes in the book to me.
True. I mean, in the thing of being worthy of Perrin, and Perrin, you know, whining, I at least will foreshadow coming up in a future Gathering Storm recap episode that, you know, they do actually do the thing that I've been screaming at them for books and books to do, which is sit down and talk.
Yeah, what a concept. Well, I think they were just on the verge of that when she got kidnapped. You know, they were actually approaching some resolution there.
Mm-hmm. And then it got cut off by
whining. And then we have the interminable, you know, capture of Fayu. And I still am never going to quite...
And then books and books of whining.
Oh, more than books and books of whining. I am still never quite sure if I'm going to forgive Robert Jordan for killing off Roland so offhandedly, basically. I really thought there would be more of a resolution issue between Fayil and Roland and Perrin at some point in time. And I guess, you know, the books just went on so long, he just had to start gutting some characters.
Yeah. One of the other things in this segment, too, that sticks out to me in the various notes that Encyclopedia Watt has left, they make a comment about it not being clear if the vision of the dragon that Massima has is Massima's madness or one of the Forsaken. When I'm reading the actual segment, it, at least in my mind, is very clear that it is one of the Forsaken.
Mm.
The dragon had appeared to him in the night before the attack, appeared in glory, a figure of light glowing in the air and shimmering, or glowing in the air in shimmering robes, sounding vaguely like the Mask of Mirrors that Mesaana used, and also the figure claiming to be Semirog used in, you know, when appearing to Seraph and various other people. So that immediately points to it, and it's the kill Perrin Ibarra. It's the get rid of Matt and Perrin plot.
Yeah.
Suddenly appearing as if by magic from the dragon. You know, it screams of that plot. You know, the dragon had commanded kill him, and so the prophet had sent his very best tool, Ibarra's own dear friend. Mwahahaha.
Yeah, that leads me to the conclusion that I mean, I know Aram has some severe psychological issues, but until a certain point, he was pretty much, you know, a slavishly loyal follower of Perrin. And as far as I know, Perrin didn't do anything to turn him off. The only thing was that he came in contact with Mithima and crowd, and that if there was a Forsaken periodically hanging out with them, you know, that might have been exactly what caused the Arab to turn. He might have had compulsion used on him. You know?
Well, by Mithima,
certainly, but whoever was running Mithima, whichever one of the Forsaken was, you know, giving him his marching orders and probably increasing his craziness. Let me also explain part of why Mithima is so nuts. If he was compulsed and, you know, manipulated and he basically used by one of the Forsaken almost since the beginning. I mean, that, you think about that, that was quite a little epiphany that Mithima had. He went from hating and despising Rand because he looked like an Aiel to, like, in the space of an hour, completely turning around, acknowledging him to be the Dragon Reborn, and then becoming the prophet of the Dragon Reborn. It's like, hello? What were you drinking?
Well, the hour that he turned around did happen to be the one where Rand was floating up in the sky fighting the Dark One. So.
Oh, yeah, but still.
But then he did, yeah, his wig out after they left the Mountains of Mist and Moraine and Lon and Perrin chased after Rand. And sent the Borderlanders on their way, and then Mithima starts freaking out and becomes the prophet. That kind of reached me of compulsion. But here's the thing. When I first read this, I thought, oh, that has to be one of the male Forsaken. And in my and I just said Forsaken, but in my mind, I automatically assumed male. But there are two things that I thought of tonight as we were reading over this. One is that it doesn't necessarily have to be male. With the channeling and the masking mirrors, there is every possibility that it could be one of the female Forsaken pretending to be Rand. It doesn't seem like the right ML, but it could be. My second one was that this reeks of something that Tyene would do. We've seen him time and time again try to become the dragon, and since Rand's been proclaimed, since Rand has stepped out and the world knows him as the Dragon Reborn, you know, even now he's still trying to usurp Rand's power and authority, and it doesn't seem beyond the realm of possibility that he would have gone to this nut job Mithima, who was claiming to be the prophet, and said, look, I'm the Dragon Reborn. I don't think that Tyene could have pulled off the turn Mithima into a prophet. I still think that was one of the Forsaken, but I think it might have been one of the ones that we've lost since then. But I would not be surprised if it was Tyene floating above his bed night before the assault on Malden.
Well, and Mithima didn't turn to, you know, he didn't have his epiphany right after Balmus. Because when they first arrive at the camp there, we see, is not that the place, oh wait, no, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe that was in the Great Hunt. I could be wrong about that. I was thinking there was a scene where Mithima was, scornful of Rand. And then something happened, maybe it was the attack by the Trollocs that sort of turned in. I don't know. No, I could be wrong about that. I think I'm wrong. I think that serving the food or swapping the food on the plate, that was in the Great Hunt when they were...
Yeah, that was the Great Hunt.
That was
definitely
the Ingtar. With Ingtar. So immediately after Falma, he became the follower of the Lord Dragon.
I don't remember that opening scene in Dragon Reborn. I know that he's there. One of the things that just occurred to me as we were doing this is that of the people who came south with Angtar's band, like all of the loyal Shinarans, Uno's the only one left.
Yeah, pretty much. Oh, no, didn't he have... No. Wait a minute.
Weren't
because
there some others that were with him,
like,
just that we didn't
like
have 12, names for?
He's got like 15 or 16 of them that they picked up in the... where they got the ship from the White Cloaks. They lost a couple of people going there, but there's like, they're the core of Bryn's heavy cavalry army now. It's like, remember, and then he was thinking, oh, well, if one Shinaran was good, then six had to be wonderful, but how much was it going to take to feed these guys? Remember, how
well,
many
yeah,
camps
but I,
did
I'm,
16 Shinarans eat? I know they haven't lost all of them.
Yeah, but how many of those 16 Shinarans had names?
No, I don't think more than a couple of them.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm saying. If all of the named characters who came south, You know, the big ones are all gone except Uno.
Yeah, okay, I'll grant you that one. Well, I think there were two named ones that were with them. The two that basically were with Nynaeve when she went to meet the prophet, and I cannot remember their names at the moment. I don't think they've gone. I think they're still around, but they'd be the only ones.
Yeah, that's possible. It's been so long since we ran into them, and if they're anywhere, I want to actually say if they're anywhere, they actually probably would have joined with the Solidar Aes Sedai and would have actually been absorbed into what is now Gareth Bryn's army under Egwene.
Yeah, those are the guys. But there's two of those guys that were named, and I just can't think of their names right now. Ragan, perhaps? Ragan or Ragan might have been one of them.
That's very possible. Well, wouldn't the other one have been Uno?
No, it was Uno. There were three of them. Remember when he first ran into Uno, and then he picked up the other two, and there were three of them with her when she went to meet the prophet the very first time. And then those three guys, she thought those three were all there were, but then they said that, you know, they had the other ones that had left. You didn't think that Bartu and Nengu or whatever would come because they really had absorbed the prophet's teachings. But the other 15 or 16 of them, or however many was, they did. They followed all the way to Solidar. They stayed there, and they became the core of Gareth Bryn's heavy cavalry. And there was one other named one besides Ragan. I'm sure Ragan's one of them, but I can't remember his name. I don't have a way to look it up right now. Sorry.
In Uno's chronology on, again, encyclopediawa.org, the most it actually says Uno, Ragan, and the rest of the Shinarans join Elaine and Nynaeve's party, blah, 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 blah. Blah, 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 blah. Uno, Ragan, and the other Shinarans agree to join Gareth Bryn's army in the Fires of Heaven, Chapter 50.
Okay, there you go.
And then later, Uno gives Nynaeve a friendly grin when she passes him in Solidar and Lord of Chaos. He watches Nynaeve as she walks by in Lord of Chaos, and Uno leads 1,000 of the Solidar Aes Sedai troops to a meeting with the Andorans and Merindians in Path of Daggers, Chapter 17.
Yeah, I was right about Ragan. I just can't remember the other guy's name. She addressed him in the Fires of Heaven when they were getting their boat and everything like that. But when Galahad was there, remember the two of them, Uno and the two other ones were facing off with Galahad, and Galahad wasn't even worried about facing three Shinar. And that was when Nynaeve realized that maybe Galahad really might be as good as everybody said he was,
Uno offers to take Nynaeve to meet the prophet, who is actually Massima, Fires Per, Chapter 38. Ragan joins Uno, Ragan, however you pronounce his name, joins Uno and Nynaeve on their visit to Massima in Fires of Heart, Chapter 39. Ragan and Uno escort Nynaeve out of Samara and meet Galahad on the way. They agree that they and most of the rest of the Shinarans will accompany Nynaeve and Elaine to Saladar.
Okay, this one, because remember there was byplay between Ragan and the other one who wasn't Uno about how, what's his name, thought that Nynaeve could play a bull at 50 paces with her tongue, and Ragan decided not to say anything, but the other guy got scowled at because he mentioned something, I'm pretty sure there were three of them. I have to go back and look it up, but I think I'm right on that. I wouldn't go to the death saying it, but I really do think I'm right. I had my Fires of Heaven, I could find it. I don't know if it's important enough to look up right now anyway. Let's move on.
Well, as with always with these ginormous Wheel of Time prologues, this one takes place of about three chapters in and of itself.
Yeah.
And especially with all the talking that we can and did do about it. And so we're going to end there for tonight, I think. Yeah, because I'm in charge of the show, so it's what I want. So there. Yeah.
He only thinks he's in charge.
Yeah. So we're going to... Yeah. So we're going to just end with a prologue for the first one. We hope to get the rest of them recorded and out to you in a quick manner so that we can have these done before release of Powers of Midnight, which I'm excited for. Are you excited for?
Oh, just a little. Yeah, I think that might be high on my list of calendar items in the upcoming weeks and months.
Tell me what you're more excited for. Which one? Both of you, individually, tell me which one you're more excited for. I think I know the answer, but I'm going to ask anyway. And then I'll answer my own question after you two. Are you more excited for Towers of Midnight or Way of Kings?
Oh, please. Towers of Midnight. Sorry, Brandon.
I actually can't say. I'll probably buy them both and, like, be thoroughly absorbed with them as well as my new class schedule with my, I'm assuming, many pages worth of reading that I will be doing every week from now until the feasible end of my next degree.
Yeah, no. Well, I'm looking forward to reading The Way of Kings too, but it just can't, I mean, I haven't got the amount of time invested in any of Brandon's work that I do in The Wheel of Time. It just can't compare. There's just no way. I mean, I have to be more anxious to see the last two books in this series.
See, and that's where I'm at too. It's just, as so many years that I've been reading The Wheel of Time, I'm super mondo excited to finish it. I am excited to read The Way of Kings and to get another book from Brandon because he is an amazing author, and I think the Stormlight Archive is going to be great. But no, the Towers of Midnight though is high on my list. Is higher on my list of things that I want to come faster than The Way of Kings release.
Yep.
Of course, if the Towers of Midnight release comes faster, that means that The Way of Kings release has to come faster too, because Towers of Midnight is later chronologically.
Yeah, I think they're at November 3rd now for release date.
Yeah, I think that was the last we'd heard.
Well, they're both going to be good. It's going to be awesome, but really looking forward to Towers of Midnight. I have to say that one thing that kind of struck me, and this may seem a little bit weird, but with the Gathering Storm, it didn't seem to provide us with as much fuel for discussion as all the previous books, but then I'll answer my own questioning wonderment on that with the fact that we're so late in the series now that The Gathering Storm was probably the first book. Well, we saw a little bit of it in Night of Dreams, but not as much. But The Gathering Storm was the first book where they really started wrapping up plot arcs, you know. And I think new ones aren't showing, you know. And we got a lot of information about the ones that got wrapped up, but we didn't necessarily get a lot of new information about the ongoing ones. Sometimes we did, but I think that's probably why. But it was not really disappointing, but in a way it was. I mean, there's a lot there, and there's a lot to dissect and discuss and talk over, but it just doesn't seem like it's as much as all the previous ones. Or is that a function of the fact that they're just coming out faster now, and, you know, we don't have as much time to really muse about everything? I mean, a book a year, wow, that's fantastic. I mean,
yeah.
God love Robert Jordan. God rest his soul, you know, may he rest in the Creator's palm, but Robert Jordan would have never given us a book a year.
Yeah. Well,
even had he not gotten there.
Yeah, I think you're right, kind of on that bit, because of the two things you mentioned. One is there's not as much time to dissect it. We haven't had as much time to dissect the last book as we've had to dissect the other 11 in the series. But also, like you say, it's wrapping up. It's finishing all these plot arcs and ending a lot of these different mysteries that we've had. Not all of them. Thank heaven for that, as they haven't all been wrapped up yet. And hopefully they won't all get wrapped up, because we still need stuff to talk about.
I know.
But yeah, I think that's a lot of the reason why that, and that our lives have gotten so complicated that we can't spend as much time as we want reading.
Well, that may be. But I still, reading is my worst vice. I still read when I should be doing other things.
So that pretty much wraps up our prologue, What the Storm Means, for The Gathering Storm. if you wish to get a hold of us, if you've seen something that we missed, or have any comments or criticisms, any ideas on future podcasts, any crazy theories, anything in general, there are a number of ways, of course, that you can get a hold of us. The first, of course, is you can call and leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
And you can always email us at podcast@dragonmount.com. Usually all of us will get that email, and usually one or more of us will respond in a fairly timely fashion. It could be mere minutes if we happen to be looking at the phone, or it might be a day or so, but generally we'll get at least one or more answers.
Yeah,
and our website is www.dragonmount.com/podcast. There you can find our archive of all our old podcasts. And after each and every episode is a comment section where you can leave comments on that episode. We go through there and we get all of your comments and we read through them and we even comment on a few of them. But there are some lively discussions that have been spawned on those comment boards. So don't be afraid to head over there. Also on dragonmount.com is forums.dragonmount.com. There is a forum devoted to the Fourth Age that needs to get used more, honestly. It's not used enough. And so, if you want to go there and start up a thread or a conversation, feel free to do that as well.
That's going to wrap up this episode. As Andrew said, we, as always, hugely value your input and greatly appreciate that you listen to the podcast. We really enjoy doing this, and we are happy to try and share our thoughts with those of our friends, and we're really happy that we've gotten to know a few of you and get to hear from you. It's great. We really love it. So we hope you enjoy it as much as we do putting it on, and I hope that you'll continue to listen to the future. And so until the next time we meet, may the light illumine you.
And until next week, may you find water and shade.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravyanin Tomanshima, Taishite.
But we want you all to know that it is there, and we are,
The only Ian I've ever actually met was a Ponzi prick.
Well, you know, Ian was my stage name when I was one of the Vegas showgirls, but I haven't gone by that for years.
That works for me. Anyway, we should probably wrap this up now that we've given the editors yet another long piece to cut out. Woo-hoo. Someday they're going to come after us with pitchforks, you know. Burning torches and pitchforks. They're going to have rogue Aes Sedai throwing fireballs at us.